Well, welcome to our PPS Success Mastery Program guest interview. Today I'm interviewing Julia Ross. Julia Ross, for those of you that don't know, is the author of two of the most well-traveled books in my library, The Diet Cure and The Mood Cure. She is also the executive director of, you're probably the executive directory too, aren't you, dear? She's the executive directory of the Recovery Systems Clinic in Mill Valley, California. Julia is an expert in the treatment of mood problems, eating disorders, and addiction to alcohol, drugs, and refined carbohydrates. She has a team of nutritional experts and holistic physicians who are internationally recognized for her amino acid therapy and her ability to offer biochemical rebalancing. Before we get started, I'd like to let any of you know that you can find out more information about her books, her clinic, her training seminars at www.moodcure.com. Julia, welcome to our PPS Success Mastery guest interview.
Thank you, Paul. I'm glad to be with you.
Well, it's lovely to have somebody with so much experience and knowledge on the call with us. We interview a lot of people from different fields so that I can share as many perspectives as I can with as many people that are willing to listen and find health and well-being. So I'm excited to be able to ask you some questions and share some of my ideas and see if we can cross-pollinate and let people know that there's lots of unique and effective ways of healing from addiction, eating disorders, and diseases.
Good.
So, Julia, my first question is that it has been my observation that most addictions, eating disorders, and diseases are coping mechanisms, attempts to alleviate stress. I know my own clinical work has shown me over and over again that stress summates in each individual. So essentially what I'm saying is that an individual's perception of themselves and their life is a combination of their physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual stressors. And I know that from my own experience, the more stress an individual is under, the more likely they are to participate in the consumption or interaction with addictive substances. Have you found that to be true yourself?
Yes, and I'd like to define stress even a little more narrowly. Definitely, it's a composite of all the elements you've just described. The reason that it can add up in my experience to addiction, whether it's to food or alcohol or drugs, is that the brain is one of the first victims of overstress, and there are very specific changes that occur in the brain when we're under continual stress. You know, we can tolerate what we were designed for, which is the occasional stressful situation, but not the stress that continues pretty much every minute of the day with noises, you know, just things we don't even, subliminal things, things we're not even really aware of as stressors, let alone all of the major stressors, you know, from interactions, from finances, and so forth. And really the top stressor of all, which we regard as the standard American diet. And so whatever the situation, you know, or combination of situations that's creating an overstress condition in the person, the way the brain responds is very consistent, and it's all about depletion. So the centers of the brain that are supposed to be programming us to feel like we can handle things, calming us down in the face of stress, all of these chemicals get depleted by too much stress, so that we end up being able to cope with it less and less. And very specifically what happens in the stress response in the brain is that the minute we are highly stressed, there's a little army of neurotransmitters that get sent out to cope. And you know, the generals of these armies, there are four of them, and they're the four neurotransmitters that, that generate positive emotion. So one of the first things that goes out is GABA, which is the neurotransmitter that's supposed to neutralize stress. It's like our natural tranquilizer, and it's got only that one function, is to turn off excessive adrenaline and all of the stress hormones, other stress hormones, like cortisol, for example. So GABA gets overused and exhausted, which means that not only do we not cope with stress very well, but we don't feel, in general, an ability to relax. Our sense of a deepening sense of self, a calmness, a peacefulness in life, you know, the ability to feel centered and grounded emotionally and spiritually, that gets eroded by stress very, very clearly. Another major player in the stress response is endorphin activity. So endorphin is another one of these neurotransmitter generals. It orders the body to, when there's enough endorphin, it orders the body to experience pleasure, and it allows it to be numb when there's excessive pain, emotional or physical pain. So this is vital to our daily lives, our sense of well-being. But levels can erode if stress has caused endorphin levels to be overused. You know, we can literally use up these precious mood stabilizing and mood enhancing chemicals. So from that point of view, we start to operate in our clinic, and I describe this particularly in the Mood Cure. How do we repair these particular ravages of stress so that someone can step out of an addiction to alcohol and drugs? And I'm sure we'll be talking about the specifics, but just in general, I can tell you that we can relieve these really critical consequences of excessive stress leading to addiction in about 15 minutes, and people can do it themselves quite easily using nutritional concentrates that go right to the brain and feed the particular brain site that's become depleted. And it's easy to identify which brain sites have become depleted. I use questionnaires in my books and on the websites so that people can very quickly, you know, in just minutes, they can identify, oh, I'm depleted here, I'm depleted here, and here are the nutrients I need to start returning myself to who I'm really intended to be.
Well, that's obviously very, very important. And that leads nicely into my next question. Today, the medical community is heavily marketing the idea that illness and disease often come from genetic mutations, essentially giving people the idea that, you know, being fat or having a disease isn't something you can control, and that it's
exactly
something that, you know, the medical system is going to have to fix for you, or that you're going to need to be on their designer drugs for the rest of your life. But I know from my own research studying the work of people like Bruce Lipton that a lot of the genetic experts out there that are being honest have sort of said essentially that no more than about 5% of all diseases are genetic in origin. I'm wondering, in your opinion, what percentage of addictions do you feel are genetically mediated as a result of some genetic malfunction? And in cases where maybe there is a genetic origin, do you feel we can manage these things through diet, nutrition, lifestyle, and the kind of supplementation you're talking about?
Well, first of all, I want to agree that all this focus on genetic mutations is totally distracting us from the real question, which is, if they're genetic, that means they've been in place for millennia, right?
Right.
So why didn't we have all of these diseases and mood disorders and addictions, you know, at this level until recently? Has there been a huge amount of radiation on the planet so that we've damaged our genes to the extent that we can't function anymore? No, what we do know, and for sure, is that the brain, for example, is fueled by specific nutrients. And if they're not present, whatever the genetic program is for the whole body, it can't be implemented properly.
Yeah.
Key to every nucleus of every cell in the body to turn on the genetic programming is a certain amount of thyroid hormone that has to be there, a certain amount of vitamin D and a certain amount of vitamin A. Those are always on that nucleus to turn on the genetic programming. And we are deficient in the nutrients that can be used to make thyroid hormone, iodine, for example, critically deficit, vitamin A, vitamin D, both typically low in Americans because of our diet. So just those few specific examples have always been convincing to me that if our diet is deficient, we cannot operate our genetic code. It just won't. And if we have vulnerabilities in the genetic code, they're going to show up.
Right.
The weakest area is going to collapse first in the genetic coding expression. So improving the diet is the key thing to protect us from allowing these vulnerabilities to express themselves. But let me just say that, for example, depression is 100 times more prevalent now than it was 100 years ago when we were eating an entirely different diet, a diet that was much closer to the diet we've been eating on the planet forever, as far as we know. So I think that we can step back from this genetic nightmare that, you know, we're involved in here, because we know now that it's been triggered by malnutrition. And the real key at this point in dealing with malnutrition is to help people with the cravings that they have for the mainstays of this terribly destructive, toxic diet that we're eating. Refined sugars and starches are some of the most addictive drug-like substances on the planet. And so we can give people this information that, you know, all of their problems will be alleviated if they improve their diet, not even to mention the other things you talk about. but if they can't follow the direction, if their brain chemistry is so depleted that they are dependent on drugs to have any kind of a sense of well-being, then what we have to do is use the nutrient supplements that I was talking about earlier to quickly jumpstart that brain chemistry, normalize the appetite. I'm talking literally in days. And then people can welcome wholesome food, traditional food, and not any longer be in the grips of the refined food industry's manipulation. No question that we're being manipulated by the refined food industry with the increased amounts of addictive sugar in particular. I was just in Germany, and it's very interesting that the breakfast cereals over there contain 40% sugar, whereas in the United States it had just been revealed just before I left about a month ago that our breakfast cereals are 55 to 75% sugar. And the plan is to gradually increase the amount of sugar in the German cereals until they're so high that people can't stop with one bowlful. You know, the whole idea is to get people eating more and more and more of this stuff at whatever cost.
Yeah. Have you ever seen the book Beating the Food Giants by Paul Stitt?
Oh, yes. That's
it's a great little awareness.
It sure is.
People that, you know, think that medicine is not
on our side.
Yeah, and that government and that, you know, everybody's living this happy, glowing, under the sun existence. I thought of an analogy while you were describing the issue with genetics, and that is, if you think of a human being like a photocopy machine that has software programs, thus the genome in it, to carry out different printing functions, if our diet and lifestyle is excessive and such that it, as a metaphor, burns up all the toner, it would be sort of a silly thing to think that it's the programming in the machine that's
yes.
incorrect.
Great example.
You know, like, I know there's been times when I'm printing out my own slideshows and I forgot to click the black and white button when I printed. So if you have a lot of deep color, like blacks and blues, you can burn through a whole barrel of toner in no time just because, you know, you didn't take the option to do things the most efficient way. And
in the case of food addiction, I would say you couldn't take the most efficient option. You know, you can't eat the right food if you're addicted. That's the definition of addiction. It's beyond your control. And so the question is, how do you get control, you know? How do you push the right button? And we know that conventional treatment is just totally ineffective. You know, it's got, at best, a 90% relapse rate, and usually quite a bit worse than that. So these little, simple, inexpensive nutritional tools that we have really allow the brain then to function normally so that you can push the right button, you know, the button that will allow you to eat and enjoy healthful food and really not any longer care if it's loaded with sugar or not.
How often do you find medical drugs serving as blocking mechanisms that are either disrupting absorption of needed amino acids or somehow modulating the biochemistry that they can't effectively utilize amino acids in their diet? Because I know in my own practice, I've had people that were farmers or athletes that were eating, you know, close enough to a good whole food diet that I wouldn't have suspected it was a problem. Yet, I've had people that, you know, have, they're taking drugs for arthritis or, you know, things like the, now we know, dangerous Vioxx for controlling inflammation, stuff that's typical, you know, prescription medical drugs. And I've seen some pretty unusual behavior in their hormonal systems, their biochemistry, their eating behaviors, their inability to digest and eliminate. Yet, otherwise, they were fairly healthy people. Have you found that we're sort of in a, you know, people's bodies have turned into Molotov cocktails that are somewhat confusing at the level of the cell?
Well, you know, even the manufacturers will admit that most of them deplete certain nutrients. Birth control pills, for example, a very common example, deplete a number of nutrients. But, you know, frankly, I think the people that you're describing are a tiny minority in this country, you know, who are eating a wholesome diet and are, most people are eating a terrible diet, plus they're taking these medications in an attempt to relieve the distress that the diet has caused. So they have this double whammy of nutrient depletions from, you know, just simple malnutrition from eating poorly, plus malnutrition, you know, being stripped of specific nutrients because of specific drugs that they're taking, and then, you know, an endless array of side effects of these drugs that no one understands exactly but are definitely working on the cellular level. You know, think of, I'm pretty focused on mood as a primary symptom, and the incredible depression that Accutane, you know, the acne medication, can trigger and does, including suicides.
As is the case with SSRI drugs.
Right, and the drugs that are so common now used for ADHD, they've just admitted that there's an increased incidence of suicide and suicidal thinking among the children that are using Ritalin.
Yeah.
Similar drugs.
You know, there's, I don't know if you know about this, there's a study that came out a couple of years ago from the UK where they looked at PET scans of brains, and they showed that they could not identify the difference between people using Ritalin and people using cocaine.
No, those two drugs are very, very similar, and that's why Ritalin is such a big black market drug now, because it gives that sort of irresistible high that cocaine can give. They call it, you know, the caviar of stimulants. It's highly coveted. Kids steal each other's Ritalin. So it works differently than methamphetamine, you know, which is in the general category of a stimulant, but doesn't have anywhere near the allure.
It's a wee bit concerning to me when you consider that I believe in 2007 we had 20% of American fifth graders on Ritalin, and we sold 15 metric tons of this stuff. Which
well,
is
here's the thing that you know, from my point of view, is so tragic about it, is that what Ritalin does is activate a particular part of the brain, one of the four brain generals, in this case, norepinephrine, which provides us with the ability to concentrate, feel enthused, energized mentally, especially, and able to concentrate. So if we're starved of the nutrients that allow the brain to build up its norepinephrine stores, we are not going to be able to concentrate. And instead of using a drug like Ritalin, we need to acknowledge that we're starving our children. Captain Crunch is completely devoid of any nutrients, let alone the complex amino acids that are required to build norepinephrine. So they go off to school with no fuel. They haven't eaten since the night before if they got any protein, which is the only food that these neurotransmitters can be made out of. So we're starving the brain of the very thing that would allow them to concentrate. And we use these nutrient supplements along with an improved higher protein diet to get these kids back on track very, very quickly. I mean, within days.
Yeah.
So it's so simple to correct if we recognize what's really going on. And if not, we're giving people highly addictive drugs in a developing brain. The brain develops until age 24. So nobody even knows what's going to happen to these kids who've been on it for so long. But one of the things that they know is that they're developing heart disease, because the accepted consequence of being on Ritalin or any other stimulant is that the heart rate goes up and it wears out the heart.
Yeah.
It's terrible, but the good news is it's easy to fix.
Yeah.
But first we have to recognize what caused it in the first place. It's real. You know, a lot of people will say, oh, people don't need antidepressants. They don't need Ritalin. You know, they just need, you know, better parenting or better teachers or whatever. And as a psychotherapist, that my background is in psychotherapy, I wish that were true, because then we could short-stop this thing. They'd never have to get on drugs. But what I know is that, unfortunately, the state of malnutrition in this country is such that the brain is deranged in most of our population. 50% of people 14 and above in this country, in a huge government study, 2006, it was determined by lengthy interviewing of these people, 40,000 of them, that 50% of us are really impaired by depression and or anxiety. That's not because we've suddenly become more psychologically unhealthy. It's because our capacity to be functional emotionally has been destroyed by our diets.
Well, you know, one of the things I'd like to sort of interject in there, and I've been working in this particular arena for a long time, so I've seen this over and over again. One of the things that really saddens me is that we have a very poor, almost non-existent system for educating prospective mothers as to the physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual requirements of mothering or parenting And I repeatedly see women getting pregnant who are so unhealthy, it's just mind-blowing. And in Native American societies, I know, I've studied numerous Native American and Aboriginal cultures to identify what their beliefs were with regard to polygamy versus monogamy, with regard to their ideas around birthing and the importance of protecting the mothers, and all related aspects. And I know a number of Native American Indian tribal societies made it a taboo for a woman to have an infant more than once every 3 years, because they found that most women's bodies could not recuperate adequately. And if they had children more than once every 3 years, it dramatically increased the chance of either the mother getting a disease or dying during childbirth. And I would imagine you would agree with me that if we could start a campaign that encouraged mothers to get fit physically and nutritionally before beginning the quest to have a child, that we might be doing the infants a hell of a big favor.
Oh, there's no question that the infants are so damaged by, being born to women who are already nutritionally depleted, and then they try and share this nutritional depletion with their child. What's left? You don't have much to begin with, and then you give some of it away. There isn't anything to give. And that's why progressively children are more and more and more unhealthy. And they don't have any capacity to stand up to the kinds of diets that they're served, once they can eat, let alone what they're getting through the umbilical cord, which is also garbage.
Yeah.
And they're just falling by the wayside, emotionally and physically, with all of the adult diseases, cancer, heart disease, diabetes, just rampant.
Yeah, it's really, it's sad, and, I know you work some with Dan Kalish, and I do as well, and actually, it was Robert Rakowski. I borrowed a slide from Robert Rakowski. And are you familiar with Robert Rakowski?
No.
Okay, well, he's a pretty famous chiropractor who is one of the lead educators for the Metagenics Corporation.
Uh-huh.
And he does a lot of work with, issues of nutrition. And he's got a beautiful slide, and it's titled From Cradle to Grave. And he shows how the drug companies have created a class of drugs for every single socioeconomical and age category in society, virtually beginning from 0 to 10 years of age and going all the way to the time of your death. And what I've noticed happening is that the drug companies are now manufacturing directly to children on television. They're literally taking advantage of the fact that kids are so dysfunctional, and instead of going after the parents, and the food manufacturers are doing the same thing, like McDonald's markets directly to the kids.
Oh, definitely. They've been doing that for years, but I didn't realize that the drug companies were marketing to kids too.
Well, what they're doing is they're using psychological hooks that are targeting the children as opposed to targeting the adults.
What kind of drugs are you talking about?
Well, just drugs in general. For example,
maybe like aspirin, or
aspirin, things for controlling inflammation. So like what's happening is, if you just watch the commercials, and I'm saying this from a different perspective. I'm saying this as a guy who teaches the science of mind, linguistics, mimetic programming, or the science of brainwashing. If you look at the way they're formulating the commercials, you see things like someone with arthritis is having a hard time interacting with the children, but all of a sudden after they've taken the pill, that grandpa is now out rafting on the river with his grandkids. So the kids are actually being given subliminal messages that say, if grandpa takes these pills, he can play with you.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So what they're doing is they're actually programming the children to reinforce the possibility that, well, maybe you'd feel better if you took the drug. I saw it on television.
Wow.
Just the same way the kids go to mother, who may not watch as much television, and say, you know, if I go to McDonald's today, I get a Happy Meal with the following toy. So they're planting the mental-emotional hooks into the children, not just the direct purchaser. They're going for everybody.
Boy, a Happy Meal. You know,
yeah.
As a mood expert who knows that McDonald's is one of the worst enemies of any sort of decent mood or any decent health, when I was in Europe, I was just heartbroken to see all the McDonald's, you know, like in downtown elegant Copenhagen. McDonald's and 7-Eleven was another thing that seemed to have glamour and was in all the shopping areas. Strange things that were exporting, doing so much damage. The Danes are still eating more of a traditional diet, but and their health is somewhat better. But the Germans are number two now in obesity, and they have really succumbed. They do a regular nutritional analysis of their children. The government has an ongoing study, which, of course, the food industry wouldn't allow our government to do anything like that and publish the results.
Yeah.
They do that in Germany. They don't pay any attention to it, but they do publish in major newspapers the results of this study. And you know, it's showing that since 1994, when McDonald's, you know, and similar fast food really inundated Germany, the content of the diet has deteriorated so much that young children have major nutrient deficits, that they're eating 100% commercial food now in Germany.
Yeah, it's pretty sad because Germany has a fairly strong organic program. But it's just really a case of awareness. You know, I'll give you an example of how that can work. One of the physicians from the Mayo Clinic took a lot of training from me, and when he took my holistic lifestyle coaching course, he said, where in the hell am I going to find organic food? I've never seen anybody selling organic food anywhere where I live in Rochester, Illinois. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, I bet you you'd be surprised if you'd just look around. I said, why don't you go to the Chamber of Commerce and ask them if there's a Farmers Association, and if there is, contact the Farmers Association and find out if they can point you in the direction of any of the organic farms in your area. Well, it wasn't days later, and he emailed me, and he said, you're not going to believe it. All these years I've been living here, and I'm surrounded by organic farms and didn't even know it.
Oh, that's fascinating. I'm glad to hear it.
Yeah.
I'm glad to hear it. I know that there's much, you know, there's increasing financial incentive for farmers to go organic, and that's great.
Yeah. And, you know, another thing that I'd like to share in lieu of our conversation here, I don't know if you know this, but did you know that in Ashland, Oregon, McDonald's went bankrupt and they had to close it down?
No.
Yeah, I think it's the only city anywhere in the United States, possibly the world, where McDonald's could not make it.
And oh, what a great story. I'm glad
yeah,
you know that.
My mother lives there and so does my son.
Ah.
And the reason I bring this up is because it's proof that if there's enough awareness in the population, that these businesses cannot survive.
Well, Ashland is you know, unusual, you know, in that most of the people that gravitate there, you know, do have an awareness before they even get there, and then being there, they're educated all the time about health. I know there are several big natural foods cooperatives in that area and so forth.
Yes.
And it's, I think it's sort of a rarefied area, and it's great. The thing that I just got a call from an old client who had moved up there. She had been bulimic for 25 years, and she came to us, and we were able to help her turn off the bulimic binging and purging very soon, you know, within a few weeks. And it's been about 7 years that she's been free of it. And she actually called because she was having cravings and was overeating. She wasn't binging or purging, but she was overeating and didn't really understand why. And in her case, she had cravings that were generated by healthy food. So she wasn't eating anything unhealthy, but she's very sensitive to gluten-containing grains. And I don't know if you've seen this, but in addition to the addictiveness of refined sugar and starch, there are a few whole foods that can be highly addictive because they increase endorphin activity. So they actually addict you by stimulating your own pain-killing, pleasure-enhancing chemistry. And certainly not everybody is sensitive to these foods and becomes addicted to them, but if your comfort foods that you can't stay away from that are causing unneeded weight gain and so forth include the gluten-containing grains, wheat, rye, oats, or barley, or dairy products, we know that casein in dairy products, one of the proteins, and gluten in these grains can have this bizarre but increasingly common addictive capacity and effect. And so how do you turn that off so that the person can back away from these foods that are healthy for other people but not for them?
You're referring to gluto and caseomorphogens, I suspect?
Well, these are called exorphins, and they are generated by those proteins, which, you know, seem to cause a lot of problems for a lot of people. They're implicated in autism as well, bipolar, lots of things. But these exorphins, as they're called, are specific to these particular proteins. And we've been hybridizing wheat in this country so that it contains more and more and more gluten and therefore is capable of doing more and more of this exorphin addiction.
Yeah. I studied somebody's program on addiction and eating disorders a couple of years ago, and they described that incomplete breakdown of gluten or casein can produce a molecular structure whereby a molecule of morphine is attached to gluten or casein, and they referred to it as glutomorphogens and caseomorphogens, and made the case that people actually get addicted to the morphine produced by the incomplete digestion of gluten and casein in dairy.
Well, that's pretty common, you know, when you talk to people about why can't you stay on, you know, a moderate diet? You know, why do you keep going back to excessive amounts of breads and pastas and so forth, typically with cheese and butter and so forth? They will say, well, those are comfort foods. I don't feel that good unless I have those in my diet. And when they try to stop and cut back, they really have a problem, and they're not able to follow through typically. So these are, you know, when you're talking about morphine, that's basically the definition of an exorphin. And endorphin is our innate morphine that we create ourselves. So the way we deal with this particular kind of addiction is to give people the fuels that will increase the endorphin activity in the brain so that our natural ability to feel good without needing this extra boost of artificial morphine is strong. In other words, we're not going to be vulnerable to this, nearly as vulnerable to this addiction if our ability to feel to be able to kill pain and generate pleasure because of our endorphin level activity is strong. If it's not strong, then we've got to have it, and we're going to look for it wherever we can find it. And if it's not sugar, it's going to be bread or cheese. Mm. And so we take care of it with these supplements that increase the endorphin activity very quickly, And giving people the information that endorphin, our natural morphine, requires the consumption of large amounts of protein. It requires 19 of the 22 amino acids to make one endorphin molecule. So we can't skip any meals with protein. You know, we can't run off with a green drink that doesn't have any protein in it in the morning. We can't have a salad for lunch. You know, so many people think that vegetables are the only healthy foods on the planet. So we've really got to literally beef up our diets if low endorphin is one of our problems. And again, this is a whole chapter in the Mood Cure is devoted to how do you decide whether your endorphin levels are deficient or not. Turns out it's very easy, and it's quite easy to build them up again too, especially if you're fighting an addiction to these comfort foods or to painkillers. Oxycodone addiction is one of the top addictions in the country. Tremendous increase in it. You know, Rush Limbaugh wasn't the only one. He's part of a huge number of people who get addicted to opiates, and alcohol is an opiate, and so is marijuana, you know, two other enormous addictors. So to get off of these particular addictions that are targeting this particular part of the brain, this low endorphin status, we've got to build up the endorphin so that we don't need these external painkillers, and it's not difficult to do. There is a chapter specifically on addiction recovery in the Mood Cure as well for people who are really concerned about this topic that you're raising.
Sure, and I'll just point out to people that it's easy to get the Diet Cure or the Mood Cure right on Amazon.com, so it's not like you have to do a big search. They're not rare, obscure, hard-to-find books. They're very easily accessible and easy to read. Yeah, that's true. One of the things that I've observed, and I love to hear your thoughts on this, I have found that probably about 95% of the people that I work with that are suffering from addiction, eating disorders, or diseases suffer concurrently fungal and parasite infections. And I've had quite a shocking amount of success at significantly alleviating or completely eliminating. I've even seen cases of anorexia and bulimia clear up immediately upon killing parasites. Have you had any observation with regard to the fact that parasites and funguses can not only modulate the immune system but rob us of tremendous amounts of nutrients, leaving us susceptible to these types of problems?
Yeah. When we've repaired the brain chemistry that typically normalizes appetite, and we still get cravings, for example, with a bulimic, you know, it still can't stay away from whatever the food is. I'm thinking of one right now who was able to stop purging, but she wasn't able to stop overeating. She cut back on the amount of food she was overeating, but she wasn't able to stop overeating, even though things were better using the amino acid supplements and other nutrient supplements and dietary changes. But it wasn't until we identified that she had parasites and eliminated the parasites that the whole problem suddenly went silent. No more cravings at all. And so we find that with occasionally with parasites. We find it much more often with yeast overgrowth. So the yeast actually live on carbohydrate. They tend to accumulate into gigantic bodies in the gut in some people, eating off of our, you know, dietary carbohydrates, and we've got to kill them to stop their, you know, ravaging appetite. So when we do kill them, again, the cravings go silent. People are no longer, you know, lured towards high-carbohydrate foods.
Yes. It's an interesting thing as well that, you know, I use an approach for killing fungal infections that's put forward by a guy named Doug Kaufman. Are you familiar with his work at all?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I use his antifungal approach. And over and over again, I've had people come back to me who I've told right up front, you're going to need to switch to a whole food organic diet, or you're going to not have near the success, even if you do the exercise and the lifestyle things. But many times people have come back to me and said, well, you know, I'm doing everything, but I'm still having these problems. And I look at their diet and I see that they're still eating commercially farmed foods, including animal meats. So I started doing some research, and one of the things that I found is that because the feedlots are feeding these animals huge amounts of grain, and the grain that they feed them is the grain that's been rejected by food inspectors because it's got high levels of mycotoxins, which means the grain itself has a fungal infection.
Oh,
I found that, yeah, so what happens
is... Well, plus the antibiotics.
Well, there's that's the other factor. So they're eating animals that basically are highly poisoned with fungal mycotoxins, and they're eating animals that were raised on high doses of antibiotics and therefore carry high amounts of pathogenic bacteria that their bodies can't fight off, and people are developing a resistance to the antibiotics, because what most people don't realize is the same exact companies that make drugs for human beings also make them for animals. So they're not only invested in keeping human beings sick, they're invested in keeping the animals sick. And I tell people all the time, you cannot expect to get healthy eating sick animals. So I bring these things up just to add to the conversation from the perspective that it's really, really important for people to realize how important it is to eat healthy plants and animals as a means of getting healthy, because even if you're diet looks textbook perfect on the plate, if the source or the origin of it is diseased, if the soil's diseased, you can't make healthy food. If the food's diseased, you can't make a healthy human being.
Well, that's basically why we have to use nutritional supplements.
Yeah.
Because people have been eating this substandard food, you know, even at the best of diets for so long. Our soils have been depleted for so long that the supplementation, at least initially, is critical. And, you know, I have to say that most people's diets is so terrible, or are so terrible, that that any approach to a more wholesome diet will improve health. But there's a ceiling to it, as you say. If, you know, if you're eating conventional vegetables and animals, you can get better, but you can't get all the way to health.
Another thing that I wanted to share with you, I don't know if you're familiar with this or not, but, you know, like you said, it takes 19 amino acids to make
endorphin molecule.
So an endorphin molecule, but which really means that an individual has to have enough complete protein in their diet, because my observation is that the number of people who cannot properly digest grains due to gluten intolerance and due to their varying ratio of metabolic needs, due to leaky gut syndrome from stress, medical drugs, etc., is very, very high. And I found it real interesting. I studied the work of Aaron Fried Pfeiffer. Are you familiar with him?
No.
Aaron Fried Pfeiffer was the only living student of Rudolf Steiner that I know of to come to this country. He was a chemist who became a biochemist from Germany, and after the Second World War ended, he came to the United States, and he bought himself a farm, which he farmed using the principles of Rudolf Steiner's biodynamic farming methods, and from the farm he funded 35 years of research into human nutrition and physiology. And one of the things he said in one of his lectures at the University of Texas all the way back in 1957 was that he had found that when they raised cattle on anabolic steroids, at that time they were using stilbestrol, and I think they still do, and that's also one of the most common bodybuilding drugs, he found that the animals...
Another thing that increases fungus.
Yeah, he found that, interestingly enough, that in animals that were raised on stilbestrol, that their meats were not complete sources of protein. And I don't remember if it was arginine or lysine, but it but the meats were missing one of the amino acids that make up a complete protein. So paradoxically, if he's correct, we have a tremendous number of people that can become amino acid deficient because their plants are so deficient in it and they're incomplete proteins and the animal foods themselves may be deficient.
Well, one of the reasons that there's such a huge incidence of depression and use of antidepressant medications is that our serotonin levels are, you know, just dropping like stones suddenly for the first time in human history. And what's behind it is that there's one amino acid that's required for the body to make serotonin, this critical antidepressant neurotransmitter in the brain. And that amino acid component of protein is called tryptophan.
Mm-hmm.
Well, tryptophan is very, levels of tryptophan are very low, are all almost always very low in any animal products compared to the availability of other amino acids. So 21 amino acids are more generously provided for in animal protein than tryptophan. So it's always going to be the first deficiency that shows up. Well, corn has almost no tryptophan in it anyway. The best corn, you know, the original corn didn't have much tryptophan in it. And now the hybridized corn has almost none. And so that's basically what's fed to these animals is corn.
Yes. Yeah,
so there's nothing to make tryptophan out of.
Right. Yeah, it's a very interesting conundrum, isn't it?
Yeah, we have to, you know, a lot of people want to be vegetarian. They want to eat corn and rice and things that are very low in protein. And so we have to educate them about how, yes, grain has a tiny amount of protein in it, and if you combine it with nuts and seeds or beans or whatever, you can get a little bit of all of the amino acids that we need. But the key phrase is a little bit. We're so deficient now, and we're such poor digesters now, that we need a lot of these foods. So we need animal protein to reverse the damage. And so we have to do a lot of education of people about animal protein, and then, you know, talk to them about the fact that some people are actually caring for animals in a humane way, you know, letting them graze, you know, on hillsides and slaughtering them, you know, in a more humane way, et cetera, so that they can consider saving their own lives by eating these animals.
Yeah, and the issue of vegetarianism is so common in my practice, and I've had to deal with the what I will call dogmas around vegetarianism so frequently, I wrote two very comprehensive articles that I'd love to inform everybody about. And I've actually had physicians call me and say those are the best articles I've ever read in my life on vegetarianism and ask for permission to give them out to their patients. And if everybody, anyone that's interested can go to Read, Listen, and Watch, which is a section on the PPS Success Mastery Center website, www.ppssuccess.com, or it's in the articles section, which I can't remember exactly. I think it's Read, Listen, and Watch on paulcheck.com. But in there are two articles. Vegetarianism Part 1 deals with the physiological or physical aspects of vegetarianism, and Vegetarianism Inside Out Part 2 looks at all the issues behind
the brainwashing.
Well, I look directly at the issues of spiritual development and all the dogma around you can't develop yourself spiritually if you're eating meat. And I do a very shocking and rudely awakening job for most people that have been indoctrinated into these dogmas, and I do things like go into religions that claim vegetarianism is the only way to make it to God, and I show on various occasions that right within their own religions, for example, in Buddhism, I found high-ranking Buddhist officials that stated for sure that Buddha was a vegetarian, and then I found other equally high-ranking vegetarian Buddhist officials that said Buddha ate meat and they eat meat. But I showed that within Buddhism, there's no agreement. And I also put together a table showing the dietary restrictions of each of the major world religions, and I said, now what do you do if you're someone that practices all world religions? You'd starve to death. Right? And so I also looked at some other factors that very few people look at, and one of the factors I brought up is, who in their right mind could claim that because they're a vegetarian, they're more spiritual than people like Chief Seattle and the native elders from all the tribes that developed beautiful spiritual philosophies that produced many
practices, yes.
And
including
they produced,
how they kill animals.
Right, you know, and so anyhow, without going into that too deeply, I think you'd probably really enjoy the...
Oh,
analysis.
I would. Love to have this as a helping tool for, you know, because we're so vulnerable. It is hideous to see a video of how animals are treated in the feedlots and in the slaughterhouses. It is enough to turn you off of eating animals for life. And so we really need this information desperately to help counter that, because the information, you know, on the nightmare of how we deal with animals is given to children at such a early age. They're so vulnerable, and they come home, and that's it for protein for them, for life.
Now, my next question we've kind of already covered, but I'll state it and just see if we can move any further into it. I wrote a book. It's an e-book, a multimedia e-book, called The Last Four Doctors You'll Ever Need, How to Get Healthy Now. And I discuss an idea that I originally got from studying the works of Hippocrates, who believed that there were three doctors, and Hippocrates felt that in his day he could track the origin of almost every single disease that his patients had, either to an inability to determine what it was that made them happy, bad diet, or a lack of rest. So he called these Dr. Diet, Dr. Quiet, and Dr. Happiness. And then, due to the fact that Hippocrates probably rarely had to deal with sedentary people 2,475 or so years ago, I took it upon myself to expand his model to include Dr. Movement. And so my question was in your opinion, if people are indeed getting adequate rest, diet, movement, and we're not so bound up in dogmas that limit one's ability to satiate the desires of body, mind, and soul, how much of a reduction in addiction, obesity, and disease would we see? Now, before you answer the question, what I'm really getting at here is that we live in what I would call a highly religious culture. Current research shows that between 85 and 92 to 95% of the world population claims religious affiliation. And as I'm sure you're very aware, most of the religions put plenty of taboos on what I call natural instinctual urges. So as we just discussed with vegetarianism, many world religions make certain foods a taboo. Like if you're Jewish, you're not supposed to eat pork. So if all of a sudden you find yourself smelling bacon and having this burning desire to have some bacon and eggs, you're in this conundrum of, you know, potentially going to hell for eating bacon. And then the religions have all these tariffs on sex, the use of your money, creativity, music, you name it. What I feel personally from my observation is that the further people get into these types of, you know, what I will refer to as dogmas, the more self-judgment they get into, and the more they have to constantly question what I would call their own natural behaviors. My observation is, in having investigated this with a lot of people, my observation is that the more trapped people get in these systems of judgment and control, that the more neurochemistry they burn up. Because a person, for example, who has issues over their sexuality or their sex, for example, you know, look at all the people that are homosexual, lesbian, and they're being put under tremendous scrutiny and pressure by the public, but by religion at large, yet they obviously have either a physiological, psychological need, imbalance, desire, whatever it may be, to participate in a same-sex relationship, yet because of the social cultural environment, it is so painful and so scary for those people, to be honest, that they walk around in a perpetual state of judgment and having to wear what you would be familiar with in psychology, especially Jungian psychology or the work of Joseph Campbell. They're wearing masks. They have to pretend to be different people. I tell people that wearing masks is like having additional windows open on your computer, and every time you wear another mask, it slows your brain and your nervous system down because you're essentially juggling more and more information, and each impulse consumes neurotransmitters. My query is, do you have any sense of agreement with my statement that the more we get, the further we get away from the four doctors and the further we get into judgment conundrums that put us against our biological instincts, do you see that that is a potential source of increased demand on our neurotransmitters and the resources that manufacture them? And if so, wouldn't it be a healthy step in the right direction for people that are addicted, have eating disorders or diseases, to maybe see that this is a great opportunity to reevaluate your philosophical position and maybe seek one that's a little bit more open-minded?
Yes, but and I can't speak for disease. I can only speak for addiction and eating disorders, but I can tell you that having worked to develop very effective methods years ago for dealing with these kinds of problems, we still had the increasing relapse rate, especially when around the time cocaine came in, went from about 50% success using those, including those kinds of psychotherapies, in with other things that we did. But then when cocaine came in, we had 100% relapse, not 50%. So the whole reason that I turned to nutrition is because of the failure of those practices alone in turning addiction around. That basically, it's a physiological problem. It's not an emotional, social problem. People can tend to deal with that level of stress if they don't also have the biochemical deficiencies in the brain. But if they have both, then you have to deal with both. But they can hang on and not use substances addictively, but just continue to suffer with their ambivalence and stress and so forth. And we don't want them to do that because stress will, again, start to sap the very neurotransmitters that we've just built up physiologically. So the priority is definitely Dr. Diet when it comes to addiction and eating disorders, but we always assess for these kinds of stressors, you know, these inner stressors, as well as outer life stressors. You know, we've got people who are doing way too much, you know, is one of the most common causes of stress, and they need very practical help in identifying what would I do if I wasn't overworking, and is it really okay? You know, another dogma that came in the 80s that we're supposed to overwork. It's very subtle, you know, I call it white-collar slavery that we've been engaging in for 30 years now.
Yeah, and I would have to say that it's been around a lot longer than the 80s, because if you read the book Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill and other people of that generation, routinely you can find you know, so-called business moguls and self-help moguls telling you that if you don't work at least 60 hours a week, you're never going to amount to anything.
But people weren't paying any attention to that. You know, we were fighting for the 40-hour week, and we won. You know, so the majority of people prior to the 80s were, you know, were more balanced.
Yeah.
Somehow that philosophy that you just described took over in the 80s, and people, you know, whole generations of people now have no idea what would people do if they weren't working all the time. It's a big struggle among young people, you know, that they work so much that they can't get into relationships. It's totally unprecedented.
Well, as I tell many people that sit right here in my office with their diseases and dysfunctions, and they say that exact thing, what am I going to do if I don't work that much? I say, I'll give you something novel. How about spending time with your kids?
Exactly.
You know,
how about doing the things we used to do?
Yeah, we've got a society that is so much more motivated to buy cars, cell phones, boob jobs, and jewelry than they are to take responsibility for the fact that they've actually produced living human beings that need to be parented. And, you know, one of the things that I teach in my 1-2-3-4 for overcoming addiction, obesity, and disease is that what a lot of people don't really pay homage to is that alcohol, cigarettes, sugar, and a variety of drugs are actually very, very safe companions for people who have found the experience of love to be painful. And I know from my own life, I grew up in a small farming town, and it just happens to be sort of a social cultural thing that farms are often places where children are little miniature slaves. And every one of my friends that I can think of lived the same existence that I did. And that was, you were working from the crack of dawn until, you know, your dad or whoever was directing the work said you were done. So I know for a fact that all of my friends came from dairy farms, cattle farms, you know, large producing farms, and all of these guys were eating right off the farm just like I was, yet the amount of alcohol, drug, cigarette, and just addictive substance abuse amongst these young men was extremely high. My brother was addicted to heavy drugs by the seventh grade and ended up committing suicide when he was 34, yet both of us were raised on the best food you could grow. And my only point is that when people
did you have addiction in your family?
What's that?
Did you have addiction in the family? Was there the genetic component?
I don't really know, because my father was an only child, and my mother's sister died of rheumatic fever, so I don't have any aunts, uncles, or cousins.
Your grandparents?
There was no indication of addiction in my grandparents. Although my grandfather did tell me that my father drowned when I was 8, but in his autopsy report they found high levels of cocaine in his bloodstream.
Wow.
So,
okay. So there was something going on.
Yeah. So there is an
early on.
Yeah, my brother and I both are, you know, I have what is sometimes referred to as an addictive personality. It may just be the nature of the beast, but I'm one of these guys that does everything full bore. I shouldn't say I can't, but I've never really been one that, you know, if I play football, I play to win. If I enter a boxing ring, I get in there with the one intention of eliminating my opponent, and there is no other discussion. If I, you know, get into marijuana, then I smoke the whole bag. I've never been a person that does things half-step. So I know that a lot of the patients that I work with have that similar personality type as well, which can be problematic if you get into substances that have biochemical
repercussions.
You know, repercussions.
Well, let me say something, though, about personality, because I think that this is something that confuses a lot of people and causes a lot of of guilt and inner injury. We used to think that there was an addictive personality, and we really don't. We really know that there isn't an addictive personality in most cases. Most people who become addicts do have this genetic vulnerability, and then the increasing addiction, you know, over time with nutritional depletion, and any time there's increased stress as well. There was a study done. It's ongoing, but at 30 years, they started publishing on the study, and it was a study of 600 men. It is a study of 600 men in the Boston area, 200 of whom became alcoholic, and because they had started testing these people at age 12, they could see what kind of an array of personalities they had. And what they saw was that they had a wide variety of personalities, including the ones who became alcoholic. There was no addictive personality. But once they started drinking and the drinking affected their brain chemistry, then their personality scores started to shift, and they started to all answer the questions in the same way and developed what we call an addicted personality. And that this personality would survive even after some of them had stopped drinking for a certain number of years, and then gradually they would come back to their original personality. So and this is a sidelight to what you're saying, because you're making the point that some people that you know who may not have any vulnerabilities to addiction and eat well could still become addicts. And so without knowing them and without knowing what their family history is, it's really hard for me to comment on that. But I would like to say one other thing which really pertains to doctor movement. And that is that when you have a very limited number of amino acids coming in from the diet, you know, in the form of protein of any kind, and you are physically active, you know, whether you're a farm worker all day or a formal athlete, there's a competition between the muscles' need for the protein and the brain's need for the protein. And the muscles will always win. So that one form of neurotransmitter malnutrition that we see is in athletes who come in and they're experiencing a lot of depression, anxiety, mysterious sadness, fatigue, and so forth. And we take a look at what's going on, we'll see that they're not eating well, but they are exercising a lot, and that we have to be very, very careful with them in the recovery period to minimize the exercise for a while so that the muscle doesn't keep taking the amino acids that they need to build up their brain.
Yes, this is exactly why I teach all my students, and it's in my book, How to Eat, Move, and Be Healthy. There's a concept I use called working out, which is catabolic, and working in, which is anabolic. So your systems like Tai Chi, Qigong, yoga done properly, not the Western combat garbage yoga that's out there.
Weight loss yoga, we call it here.
Yeah, well, I call it yoga for idiots by idiots, because yoga done correctly is a beautiful, well-thought-out system. But like everything, we take a beautiful plant called tobacco that was used for numerous ailments for thousands of years by shaman, and then what do? We add sugar to it, poison it, create commercial garbage out of it, addict everybody to it,
and totally
lose sight of the beauty of the plant. Same with sugar. You know, all these things, most of them originated from something in nature that had a good source.
Sure.
But I forgot what I was going to tell you there, but that's all right. It was
in your book.
So what I'm saying is that, you know, frequently, as you can imagine, as a guy who's a consultant to professional sports teams all over the world and professional athletes, you know, I'm dealing with people that have essentially burnt themselves out from over-exercising. So I use work-in technologies. And for anybody that has an energy crisis, which is easily identifiable in my book, How to Eat, Move, and Be Healthy, because I have a series of questionnaires and we total up your total stress score. And if you have more than a certain number of points, I direct you in the book to exercise programs that are not workout, they're work-in programs. And they're exercises that, by definition, to be a work-in exercise, you must be able to do it on a full stomach. And the exercise should not increase respiratory rate or heart rate.
Uh-huh.
So those technologies that I share actually leave you with more energy than when you started. So with all of my patients that are unhealthy, have addictions and disorders like we're discussing here, probably 90% of them I have to put into a significant phase of work-in exercises. And the other thing about work-in exercises that is absolutely critical to recovery from any of these things we're discussing is that they normalize what are called biological oscillators. They're in a healthy body, there is an octave relationship between the brain waves, the electromagnetic field of the heart, and the electromagnetic field of the small intestine. So each of those are what's called a biological oscillator, and they generate an electromagnetic field. Every time you think, it generates an electromagnetic field, thus the electroencephalogram. The heart produces the electrocardiogram, and the small intestine produces a wave of peristalsis about once every 10 seconds. So research by HeartMath showed that in healthy people, there is a balanced rhythmic numerical ratio that indicates that there is synergy between these electrical generators in our body, yet in unhealthy people, when they take the respiratory rate and divide it into the heart rate, they get a fractionated number. So if you're a healthy person, for example, at rest, if your heart rate was 60 and your respiratory rate was 12, you'd get 5, or a whole number. But if your heart rate was 63 at a respiratory rate of 12, you'd get a fractionated number. The more fractionated the number is, typically the more stress the body is under. And interestingly enough, in my studies of Rudolf Steiner's work, I found a lecture he gave sometime around 1916 where he described exactly that, which blew me away. So I'm just adding to the conversation such that it's important for people to realize that, you know, burning yourself out with exercise is as bad as doing none at all, yet movement is absolutely critical to optimizing physiological and biological function. And isn't it interesting that 95% of the U.S. population is constipated, which is one of the first side effects of a lack of movement. And once you're constipated, your digestive system will shut down. And if you get constipated enough, you'll get auto-intoxication, which poisons the body. And then you have people running around eating sugar all the time because they're exhausted and starving to death.
It's funny that protein still has the reputation of being the big constipator when nobody's really eating it anymore, and we have 95% rates of constipation.
Well, you know, as I'm sure you're aware, anything that throws the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems out of balance in the direction of sympathetic, in my 25 years of clinical practice, I've only found about two people that were parasympathetic dominant, which means, you know,
calm and centered.
Yeah, well, when it's a pathology, though, what you get is excessive diarrhea. They can never normalize their bowel movements.
Uh-huh.
They're hungry all the time. They can eat until they're chock-a-block full, but they're still hungry. And their transit times and retention times are very, very accelerated. But usually it has some kind of a biochemical imbalance has taken place, or it's the effect of a drug. For example, some of the beta blockers won't let your sympathetic nervous system turn on effectively.
Uh-huh.
So you can become overly parasympathetic.
Well, that's the idea. And since, you know, you're overly sympathetic to begin with, it's a very tempting drug. The number of people having panic attacks, you know, is just incredible. It's one of the reasons that women are now more likely to have heart disease than men.
Yeah. So it's, you know, this is one of the beauties, I think, of sharing our knowledge with other people, because we can find out, you know, how to use exercise therapeutically, how to use supplementation therapeutically, and probably the most beautiful thing is that you and I both offer solutions that really don't require a lot of money or a lot of, you know, advanced medical guidance. If you want to, you know, follow the work in your books and follow the work in my books, a lot of people out there that are really suffering a lot of discomfort, spending a huge amount of money on drugs and visits to doctors, spending hours in lines at drugstores waiting to get prescriptions filled, suffering.
Spending money on prescriptions that they don't have anymore.
Yeah, and also just suffering the side effects that, and the, you know, as you and I both know, the side effects of a lot of these drugs cause diseases in their own right. I mean, I'll give you a classic example. I've pointed this out to my wife. I find this really shocking. I have seen on several occasions now, you know, in television how they will sell you a drug and then right at the end of the commercial they'll hire a professional auctioneer to tell you all the side effects?
Yes, yes. Talking so fast that you can't understand what they're saying.
Hey, well, what I have heard now on multiple occasions, which blows my mind, that viral infection is one of the side effects of some of the drugs they're selling.
No.
Yeah, absolutely. One of them, I believe, was a drug to help you sleep better.
Oh.
And in the side effects, it was viral infections. And then another drug, I recently was sitting in an airport or something, and it was a completely different drug, and again, the words viral infections came up, and I thought,
wow.
I mean, who in the world would buy a drug to help you sleep better if it was going to give you viral? that people even buy that stuff means that we really, really have some serious brain chemistry problems out there.
We do. Well, you can't, you really can't function, whether it's mentally or physically, on the diet that's currently being consumed in the United States. It's impossible to think clearly. And that's, you know, one of the reasons that people go to caffeine. We are, you know, a well-known, you know, enemy to all the Starbucks in our area because they lose customers immediately whenever they start our program. One of the things that we dislike the most about caffeine is that it helps along malnutrition, you know, by turning off your appetite for food. So it's the first thing that goes when we talk to people about changing their diets. And it's very easy for them to give up caffeine because they are using the supplement that builds up our natural brain's caffeine, you know, in 24 hours, and eating more protein, which is high in tyrosine, which is that amino acid that actually fuels the center of the brain that allows us to concentrate and have energy.
You know, which brings up a nice kind of closing commentary. You know, I teach all my students, and, you know, I teach people how to be health and lifestyle coaches for a living, and I have about 10,000 students around the world right now, so there's, you know, it's literally like it's growing into a profession of its own. And the philosophy that I live and teach is what I call the 80-20 rule. I say if you eat right and live right, which means be in concert with Dr. Diet, Dr. Quiet, Dr. Movement, and Dr. Happiness, 80% of the time, you can get away with partying a little bit and having fun and, you know, having a caffeine or going out to hitting the dance floor and participating in, you know, your favorite recreational drugs. And I've found over and over again that if you tell people you must not do this, you've got to stop this, that they'll just stop participating and being your patient. So I found years ago I had to take much more of a Taoist approach and walk the middle road. And I also noticed that it's true from my own perspective. For example, I'm a guy that loves his espresso. And people have many times seen me drinking espresso, you know, on the road or whatever, after they've taken one of my lectures and go, oh, my God, I can't believe you're drinking espresso. How could you do that? And I say, well, did you hear me asking you for help? No, that's because I don't have a problem. I can manage myself, and it's not creating a detriment in my life because I have good nutrition, good exercise, I manage my work-rest ratios, and I'm what you call a healthy guy. And I know in studies of many populations around the world, including the Hunzas, they found numerous citations where people had been smoking cigarettes their entire lifetime and had excellent health all the way up to 100 years of age because their diet and lifestyle was significant enough to support, you know, what you would call potentially addictive behaviors. They found, for example, many of these elderly people were regular consumers of vodka, because a lot of them were in the Eastern Bloc regions. And I think it's just important for me as a healthcare professional to state my position that I'm not somebody that comes expects people to become monks when they come to my institute. I'm just someone that says, look, if you want to get healthy, you've got to do what it takes to maintain health. And if you want to drink coffee and smoke cigarettes and drink alcohol, well, then you have to be that much more committed to your addiction. In other words, you've got to really, just like an athlete, if you want to win a tennis tournament, you're going to have to train. If you want to get in a boxing match, you better know that conditioning for a boxing match is an essential component to success. Nobody can win a boxing match without conditioning for it. And I say, if you want to have a relationship with alcohol, cigarettes, recreational drugs, then you really need to get clear that you have to train for it.
Well, I would just wonder, you know, why you'd want that, you know, why it would be important. And typically, whatever struggle is involved can be eliminated using the neurotransmitter fuels. So whether it's for caffeine or whatever else, you know, if you're going to go to a lot of work to support a habit and keep it from getting too destructive, my question would be, why would you want to go to all that effort? Let's see if we can't very simply, easily turn it off. And if not, fine. But if we can, and we have found, you know, that it's very easy to turn off a moderate craving like that.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of factors involved in there because I've lived through this myself. One, I personally love my espresso.
Well, anytime somebody uses the word love, whether it's for chocolate or espresso or, you know, whatever, bread, then that's an endorphin hit. And it's interesting that caffeine can give you that because you think of it as a pure stimulant, but really it's not for a lot of people. They just love the smell and the taste and everything else. Some people are like that with tobacco, too. So if you have that kind of a response to something, then we would just say, hey, take a look at your endorphin function and see if it's high enough. And here's some easy ways to boost it up, you know, within 24 hours and see whether you still care about the espresso or not.
Oh, sure, yeah. You know, and there's that reality. But, you know, on the same plate with my espresso is my love of food, my love of exercise, my love of art, my love of music, my love of sex, etc. You know, so I think there's two kinds of love. There's love that's programmed from the inside because you have an addiction, and there's love because it's something that you're passionate with. And having investigated this carefully, for example, a lot of my clients, as I mentioned earlier, are professional athletes, you know, and they say things like, have you ever been to a party? And, and you know, notice that everybody there is snorting cocaine, drinking alcohol, and doing their favorite drugs, and I'm walking around with a glass of water looking like the, you know, the village idiot. So, you know, what I found is there is a lot of social cultural pressure.
Absolutely.
In environments, particularly where we would call them entertaining environments, like dance floors, parties,
yeah,
social groups. I also do a lot of work with football players and rugby players. And amongst that crew, if you turn down a bottle of beer, then you have a great big label on your head that says pussy. And so a lot of these groups of people are not groups of people, I can promise you, even if the world's greatest therapist, such as yourself, who could remove the addiction, unless you can totally transform the social cultural environment and give somebody a healthy enough ego that they don't feel they need to participate in these types of things to fit in, then we're always going to have this reality. And
mm-hmm.
I know
true.
That reality is a lot stronger than my wish that they didn't participate. I tell them, look, the same way you've got to train for an event, a bodybuilding contest, a marathon, triathlon, if you want to participate in that kind of substance use for any reason, social, cultural, or otherwise.
Well, no, but those are very different. Outside pressure to use is very different from an inner love of something. You know, that inner state that gets satisfied by a substance, you know, that needs the substance, is very different from wanting to fit in. If you have both, then it's double hard.
Yeah.
But I would say they're two different problems. And if you don't have the inner urge for the substance and you just use it socially, then you're probably not going to get in trouble with social use. But
yeah.
If you have both, then you really do have to be careful. And if you've already been addicted, for example, like somebody who's thrown off a team because of problems resulting from addiction and then goes back, what are they going to do, you know?
Yeah, very tough.
Yeah.
And strangely enough, I don't know if you know about this, but I've done a fair bit of consulting in the sport of professional hockey.
Uh-huh.
A lot of these guys are downing cough medicines with high levels of ephedra in them before they play because it jacks them up.
Uh-huh.
A lot of the hockey games happen at 9 o'clock at night, which is a terrible time for a professional.
Really?
Yeah, they play. The reason they do it is to get television coverage where people are television. So these guys are, you know, any of us, you know, who has an earth-made body, when the sun goes down, as I'm sure you're well aware, your cortisol levels drop down, your melatonin levels rise up.
Right.
So,
time,
you know,
for bed.
I teach athletes that if you want to get the best out of your training, you need to do it between 10 a.m. and noon when your cortisol levels are at peak.
Yeah.
Here's all these athletes who are getting on the ice at 9 o'clock at night after having flown from another time zone, and these guys are doing something like 80 to 85 games a year.
Oh.
Right? So imagine that. So, you know, I've been consulted a couple of times now because they're having a lot of problems with addiction to cough medicines.
Wow.
And I've also seen plenty of problems with addiction to inhalers with high doses of ephedra in these things.
Uh-huh.
But,
wow.
Well, it's certainly been a pleasure, Julia, and I think for me, one of the most important messages of our interview today was that there are some very, very powerful, simple, effective technologies available that don't require a prescription, that really someone could simply read your book, follow the advice, and get some major relief. And if that didn't work, they certainly could come down and book an appointment with you or one of your staff.
Well, I'm glad that you got that out of this, and because it's certainly true. We don't have to feel mystified and hopeless about landing ourselves in a terrible physical, mental, or emotional states.
Well, thank you so much for all your hard work. My final question for you, which I usually ask people in these types of interviews, is if you had one message to give your fellow human beings before you leave this planet for any unknown reason, what would it be?
It would be to do everything possible to return to the dietary practices that were original to this planet.
I would say that would be a real good one, because to do that we'd have to turn to the original farming and animal care practices.
That's right.
As healing for the planet as it would be for the people, wouldn't it?
Yeah, we'd have to move around a lot more to do that. It would solve an awful lot of things.
We would all be eating, moving, and being healthy, wouldn't we?
And hopefully that would make us happy.
Yes.
Not everybody wants to be a farmer, though, so we'd have to work something out.
Sure, you know, the farmers would love the support that they would get from actually having people, you know, put money in their pockets. I give a lecture called You Are What You Eat, and I make a very, very clear and sad case. When I was in Tahiti a few years back on vacation, I saw something that shocked me to the core. So I took a lot of pictures and interviewed people. I went to the farmer's market in Papeete, Tahiti, which is a huge kind of like barn-like building, and there was hardly anybody there. And I went there several times, and I saw all this beautiful fish and produce, and they were standing there for hours while the flies ate it all up.
Yeah.
And I just happened to be, you know, kind of just touring around the town, and I walked down the street. And I saw hundreds of people in a lineup, and I thought, my God, what's going on? There must be a rock concert or something going on down there. So I walked down there, and lo and behold, there was about 500 or 600 people in a line, 4 people wide, trying to get into McDonald's. And I
no!
And my, like, and
oh.
all the natives outside of town were beautiful. Clean,
oh,
skin, and the average person in line to get into McDonald's was obese with terrible skin, bags under their eyes. So I thought, my God, I got to take a picture of this. So I took some pictures. I took pictures of the menu at McDonald's for a reason I'll expose here in a second, and I got kicked off the premise for taking pictures of their menu. And then I went to the farmer's market, and I started asking the different farmers if I could take a picture of them and their food. Well, one of the farmers didn't understand what I was saying, so they kept saying to me in Tahitian that they didn't understand. Well, my luck was right as this guy was walking by who was a Tahitian who also spoke English. He said, they don't understand why you want to take pictures. He says, I can help you translate. Why do you want to take pictures? And I explained to him that I did a lot of writing and researching in the area of food and health, and that I was absolutely just shocked at the fact that all this food was hardly being even looked at or purchased by any, but right down the street, there were hundreds of people trying to get lunch at McDonald's. And the guy said, well, let me tell you something. He said, I'm a flight attendant for United Airlines, and I was working for United Airlines when they built that McDonald's. And he said, you are standing in the building that used to be the most heavily populated and popular building in our entire city, and once McDonald's opened, this place, these farmers can barely stay alive. And he said, to make it worse, McDonald's flies all their food in. They don't use any of the local farmers. They don't use the local anything. They fly it all in, and he said, and it costs them so much to fly it in here that they have to be selling it at a loss, because I know the prices that they ship the food in here. And I showed photographs, and for 170 francs, you could get a cheeseburger. For 175 francs, you could get a fillet of fish. Yet to buy 2 root vegetables, 2 potatoes, was 190 to 250 francs, depending on which farmer you bought it from. So they literally made it so you could buy a quarter pounder and cheese cheaper than you could buy even one fish. You could buy a...
Or one potato.
It was mind-blowing. Like, so, you know, in the minds of the people in the third world country, they thought they were getting a great deal. And so now the farmers are all starving to death, the population suffering from malnutrition and getting highly addicted. Well, McDonald's is essentially taking a loss to addict the people. And, you know...
Oh.
It's really, really, really sad. So, you know, I only bring this up because I agree with your point, and I just hope that we can
you and myself and everybody that's got this level of awareness and anyone that listens to this interview realizes the absolute truth of the fact that it doesn't matter who you vote for. I don't believe we have a White House. I believe we have a corporate headquarters. And the most powerful vote is what you spend your money on. If you buy garbage food and medical drugs when you could be taking care of things naturally, you've just voted. You voted for the corporations that have got us to the situation we're in. If you support local farmers, eat real food, and choose to take care of yourself instead of expecting somebody to give you a magic pill, then the reality of what you just said in our interview, that the rate of addiction is so far higher than it was in 1900, something seriously wrong, then it's only going to get worse.
You're right. It's hard to imagine it, but it will get worse.
Yeah. Well, Julia, it's been a pleasure. I really appreciate you sharing so much of your time with us.
Well, you're welcome.
And I'm
glad to be here with you and join forces with you.
Yes, well, thank you, and I look forward to figuring out ways we can do much more together, and, you know, I really embrace your very clear, very simple, and very effective approach, and I think you and I share a mentor in common along the way, which was Bill Timmons.
Oh, one that I really miss.
Yeah, wasn't he a beautiful soul?
Yes. He really got a lot of information out through us, though. I know he'll be glad.
Yeah, so it's nice that you and I both share in his legacy.
Well, I agree, and I look forward to working with you again.
Thank you, Julie. You have a lovely day, and bye-bye.
Bye.